the North Culture Show. Woman's Hour, Charlie and Lola, Alan Partridge, Sherlock. News at 6 o'clock. Live Aid, Likely Lads, Michael Palin. No ads. It's life, that's life. Life, one of the good life. Captain Pugwash, Tony Hart, Till Death Do Us Part. Ken Bruce, News Quiz, keeping up appearances. Outnumbered Miranda. Who do you think you are? Kirsty Walk, Maxman, Parkinson and Wogan. Tripods, Five and Sam. The Ascent of Man. Watch Formula One, Blue Peter, Swap Shop, Five Live, Top of the Pops, Trumpton and the Archers. That was the week that was. Goodies and songs of praise, World of Wonder, day to day. Sorry, I haven't a clue, not the 9 o'clock news. Nationwide, Mr. Men, Doctor Who again. EastEnders, Bottom, Gary Lineker. Radio 1, Radio 2, did I mention Doctor Who? Ripping yarns, Johnny Ball, Test Match, Smashio.
So welcome to your first Amiens class on this summer's day. I'm trying to work out how to work all these things. First of all, apologise for the emails I sent you this morning, which I should have sent to somebody else. Okay, so I'll get that sorted soon. So here we are. You can ask questions at any time. I find that, in fact, although it's a little bit more impersonal, it's easier. If you ask questions in the chat, don't bother writing in the chat if it's just to say I'm sorry I'm late or I have to leave now, because that way I'll have to look at them. Now let's see if I can look at me. Can I have me? Nope, that's not me. That's you. Where's me? Oh, there's me. No, but I only want me. No, that's you. Can I have me? I'm not managing this very well, am I? Yes, it's quite difficult to do this. Okay, so let's get started. As I say, write a question into the chat if you have a question. Contrary to what I said in the wrong email this morning, there are 18 hours of BBC classes. Many of these will be on video. Many of these will be videos which I make at home, and then I give you the link, and there's no exchange. However, some of them, like today, will be live classes. Well, live classes online, because Amiens is too far for me to come, and also I work on Wednesday at my first job, which is at the University of Rouen. If you want to know about me, you can just search for John Mullen University of Rouen, and you'll be able to see the things I have written about, mostly about the history of popular music, which is my speciality. So, you have already discovered, perhaps, the teaching blog. This is where you will get a huge amount of information. Indeed, if you look in the search engine at the top on the left and you write BBC, you will find a very large number of posts about the BBC, because I taught the BBC last year. My classes were not quite as good last year, but they were pretty good. And so you can there's a lot of links to videos, sometimes documentaries about events from the BBC history, sometimes example programs for the past. So do have a look around there. Just a moment, just a word about the sample programs from the past. Very often, what you need to do is to watch 5 or 10 minutes to get an idea of what kind of sitcom, what kind of documentary. You don't have time to. You don't have time to really watch them, unless they're just so good you can't put them down. Also, lots of useful dates and so on. Now, that means with those posts on the blog, and also with the books, which I'm going to recommend, you will quite rapidly have a large number of facts about the BBC. Often about specific episodes, you know, sitcoms in the 1970s, radio news in the 1930s, the BBC and propaganda during the war. So lots of facts. So what I'm going to do, and it's not too difficult to get facts. In fact, if you read Wikipedia on the BBC and then the other ones next to it, you'll already have loads of facts. And you need a lot of facts. But what I'm going to try to do in the classes then is try to get the links and put them into a stream so that when you get the question on the exam, because I know you're interested in learning the history of the BBC, but you also probably want to pass the AGREG. I would think so. I hope so. Then you will probably, if it comes up, you will probably get a very general question. The BBC and modernity, the BBC and social changes, the BBC and women, the BBC and ethnic diversity, the BBC and the family, the BBC and war, the BBC and government, the BBC and identity, the BBC and fiction. So it's very, very large, and what you have to do is not give hundreds of examples, but choose a good choice of 10, 15, 20 examples to build your argument with. Notice that your examples must be rather varied. If all your examples are from television after 1960, whatever the question, not good. You should definitely have a good chunk about radio before the First World War. I'm sorry, before the Second World War. Good point. So it's got to be kind of balanced. Radio is fascinating before we will go into this. Radio is fascinating before the Second World War. Was extremely important to people, and very importantly from a historian's point of view, radio was not a preparation for television. That's not how history works. Just like theatre was not a preparation for cinema. It has its own logic and it does its own thing. Okay, so I do have a couple of books to recommend. And as you know, on the, perhaps you don't know, but on the website of the SAES, the Société des Anglicistes de l'Enseignement Supérieur, you have this enormous, bibliography, which I wrote because, in fact, I have to admit that I hope you like the subject of the BBC, but if you don't like it, it's actually my fault because I was the person who wrote the question. Okay, so I don't really apologise about that. I don't really care, but there you go. This is a very, very long bibliography. It's essentially intended for the people who are going to teach the classes, not the people who are going to take it. So don't worry about it, but do have a look because there's quite a number of articles, and of course articles are much easier to have time to read 20 pages than books. I'm not saying don't read books, but you know there are, I think I what's amusing about this is I decided that for the bibliography I only wanted to put 100 references. Sometimes colleagues write 300 references on their bibliography. I was being limited, but you can see it's very, very long. The three books I recommend are these. On the left, then, an introductory history of British broadcasting, which is not only about you only have to read the part up to 1995, of course. Which is not only about the BBC, but remember that from 1922 until 1954 there was only the BBC, and then from 1954 commercial television arrived, but there was only BBC Radio until 1973. So obviously there's a big part of the BBC. In the middle, I must admit, this is probably abusive advertising because I wrote one of the chapters in the book in the middle. I wrote the chapter about the BBC and popular music. And then on the right, a book by Hone Dickerson, which is who knows a lot more than I do about the BBC, and very good, very, very good piece there. This one, rather than, she published another one. Hone Dickerson and George Fournier published together another book, which is not pictured here, which I don't think is quite as useful to you. Now, remember, I'm English. That means I don't think it's useful to you. when I say it, don't think it's quite as useful. Don't bother the other one. It goes into too many details about other questions, in my opinion, for preparing the Greg. So there you go. Remember, don't hesitate to put a question in the blog, in the chat if you have one. Another wonderful place to go is the free online journal, the Revue Française de Civilisation Britannique, French Journal of British Studies, of which I was the editor until last week. Last week I passed it on to someone else. But we did this, the BBC and Public Service Broadcasting in the 20th Century, which I think is an excellent issue. And in particular, there is an interview with the official historian of the BBC today, which opens up the question of how do you write a history of the BBC? The BBC produced over a million hours of programmes between 1922 and 1995. So how can you possibly have a history of that? It's so huge. Well, that's my job, and I will be telling you about that in a moment. And that is my email address. I have two email addresses, but don't send a message to both of them, because one of them leads to the other, and I receive everything. If I don't answer your email, it's because I don't like you. I always answer emails normally. Okay, that's supposed to be a joke. It wasn't very funny, was it? Oh, well, there you go. So, what is the structure of the classes? Some of these live and some of these on video. I haven't decided exactly which ones for the moment. First of all, a general introduction, that's going to be today. This is being recorded. Now, it's being recorded by Zoom, but the problem with the Zoom is I can't seem to stop having the images of students on it. So that means I will only make the link to this video available to you. I won't put it on YouTube or anything, because, you know, that's not... the police will come and get me or something. Probably not. But it's also being recorded here, which in some ways might be even more useful. This will give an MP3, and in fact, an MP3 could be quite useful, because you can listen to it while you're going shopping or in your car if you can drive. And so for revision, I think that could be good, because it can be quite dense. I'm hoping it's going to be quite dense. I'm hoping so, full of intelligent things. Following that, I'm going to look at today, going to begin today, the whole thing. What questions need to be asked about the history of the BBC? This is my favourite historian's question. Because if you have a million hours of programmes, well, you can't just say, oh, well, the programmes will tell us what we need to know. You must ask specific questions, or it's too vast. And so, what are the important questions? Now, of course, that's partly a matter of opinion, but that's what I'm going to be looking at today. The different, I'll be giving you 100 examples of questions from different points of view. This will be followed up, certainly on video, by a look at the Director Generals. There were 12 Director Generals, and so some of the important things about them and what they and some of the decisions they made. And then the Committees of Inquiry is extremely important. Regularly, the government got an official committee together to discuss what should we do with broadcasting. And this is not just a question of whether they were Conservative or Labour. There were so many things people didn't know about broadcasting, and governments didn't know about broadcasting, so they really needed people to spend a few weeks in meetings to get the information. Say, well, you know, what difference would it make if we opened commercial television as well as public service television? What difference would it make? Okay, could I just check here? Can you see the slide with the contents page there? Yep, good, fine. So the Committee of Inquiry. Next section is theoretical considerations. An introduction to a few thinkers who have looked at what does the radio do to us? What does the television do to us? And the most important thing to retain is that it is completely false to think that people believe everything they see on the televisions. It's demonstrably false. And finally, and the last section is by far the longest section. In fact, the BBC decade by decade is probably half of the total. And I will be just going literally through the 20s, then the 30s, then the 40s, then the 50s, until I get to the end. I have a certain amount of flexibility to look at other questions which interest you. So do send me an email if there's some particular aspect or question you would might like me to look at. If you have technical problems with Zoom, don't send me an email about that, because I know nothing about it. So, let me get started, the general introduction. Well, the BBC represents the oldest example of a generally recognised principle in democratic countries in Europe, at least, that although having newspapers owned by the state or run by the government is considered to be a very negative thing. Yeah, we don't like the idea that the government should run, and there is no government newspaper in Britain, whereas, of course, there was in the Eastern European less democratic countries. And in general, this is a consensus. We don't want government newspapers. However, in general, it is a consensus that public service broadcasting is necessary. So there's some interesting contradiction there. Now, the BBC, if we start with its name, the British Broadcasting Company, and then after 1927, British Broadcasting Corporation. The company was there to make money. It was a private company like every other company, but then in 1927 it became a public corporation whose aim was not to make money, but as a public service. And the BBC, so you can look at the individual questions. British, how British is the BBC? Is BBC television full of foreign productions? Fascinating point is that if you look in the 1980s, or even today, if you look at the top 10 cinema films which are successful in Britain, 7 of them at least will be American. However, if you look at the top 20 most popular television programmes, 20 out of 20 will be British. So there's something very interesting about broadcasting, which is very much more national than is cinema. British Broadcasting Corporation, I looked at British broadcasting. Well, it was a completely new and extremely exciting idea in the 20s. People who worked in radio were in the avant-garde of technology, and they were very, very excited. You have to imagine people who work today on sending astronauts to Mars or something. It was going to be incredible. One person could talk and 10 million people could listen. It was absolutely ridiculous. Previously, 2,000, 5,000, maximum 5,000. No microphones, you see. Politicians spent their time going around the country speaking to thousands of people. When they had a big demonstrations in London, in Hyde Park, you know, political demonstrations, they would have 20 stages all around the park, and the speakers would go and give 10 minutes here, and then the same 10 minutes while the speakers would follow each other around, no microphones. So broadcasting was this incredible idea and very, very exciting. Oh, I wonder if we can get the quality well enough to put opera on the radio for everybody. Of course, opera is very expensive and it's only for the tiny minority, but maybe we could give opera to everybody. A very, very exciting time. And finally, corporation, this idea of public service, and which was at the base of a huge continuing conversation. Je l'ai dit au débat, mais en fait c'est plus une engueulade qu'un débat, alors on va dire conversation. Is public service broadcasting better? Is public service radio better than commercial radio? Is public service television better than commercial television? Of course, there is no easy answer to this. In any case, the history of the BBC is run by three principles. First of all, the BBC wanted to serve the status quo. In defence of elite interests. Every time they speak about strikers on the BBC, they are presented as a problem. When they talk about protest, it's presented as a problem. It's very much an establishment point of view. First priority. Not the first, but there are three parallel priorities. Priority number two, trying to provide for the requirements of a mass of millions of viewers and listeners. What do they want? What do they need? Should we give them what they want? Should we give them what they need? Who knows what they want? Who knows what they need? And all this kind of debate going on. But that's not the end of it, because the BBC cannot just produce what the management think is good and give it to the viewers, because they have to have creative teams. They have to have artists who write sitcoms or write dramas or write music shows or whatever. And as you know, or maybe you don't know, but I can inform you, artists are very awkward people. You can't just tell them to do this and they do it. That's not what they're like, yeah? And so there's always this tension between negotiating with creative teams, negotiating with ideas of what the mass of the people need and or want. Because even if even when people use the slogan, let's give the people what they want, it's not so easy to define. And of course, certainly at many times, people didn't know it. For example, in 1945, they begin a little more television. How could they possibly give people through the television what they want? People didn't have television, so they certainly had no idea what they wanted from television. So these tensions are a key element in the development of BBC programming in the 20th century, which brings me back to, this is what I want written on my gravestone, in fact. I think contradictory is the word you're looking for, because the BBC is a contradictory institution. This is not surprising. All long-lasting institutions, like, you know, the Church of England or the trade union movement, they're always contradictory because that's the way they survive in the long period. Now, the BBC does have an extremely good reputation. Throughout its history, the BBC has enjoyed a worldwide reputation for quality program production. A fact which has allowed them to make a lot of money selling programmes around the world, and therefore to have quite a lot of money to fund new and innovative projects. And also this reputation has helped to support those people who think public service broadcasting is better. Even though, in a period, certainly from the 70s on, where private suppliers have been rising and rising, and in general, privatisation was in the air in Britain from the mid 70s, and of course, the Margaret Thatcher governments privatised many things which previously had been considered to be public services. Just one example. Here you have four examples on the screen. Can you see four? Great, wonderful. You have four examples on the screen of documentary series. So, for example, The Shock of the New, I think there were 8 one-hour episodes, something like that, or 12. So these are documentary series. The BBC has produced 40 or 50 in the period on the television in the 70s, 80s and 90s, 40 or 50, but four is enough. And the reason I've chosen to show you these documentary series, you can find episodes of them on YouTube, but I recommend you just watch 10 or 15 minutes. You don't have time to watch a whole load of documentary series. The Shock of the New is the history of modern arts. The Fall of Eagles is the history of the collapse of enormous empires in the 19th century, the Romanov Empire, the Habsburg Empire, and other people like that. The People's Century in 2000, so it's a little bit later in fact, there's a slight cheating there, is history from below in Britain, and The Ascent of Man is an anthropological history of humanity in general. Now, very often the illustrations I used are from the DVDs, but they were originally television programs before DVDs existed. Now, the reason I give you the example of documentary series is that of all the genres of programmes, this is the strongest argument for people who said public service television is better. If you look at sitcoms, there are some very good sitcoms on the BBC. There are some very good sitcoms on the commercial television. Difficult to demonstrate that one is better. If you look at music programmes, again, there are some very good ones. Difficult to demonstrate. Documentary series appears to be a little bit of an exception. I know of 10 or 15 very good, very popular and very good documentary series, and really mass education. And so because I have 5,000 friends on Facebook and they're all very old like me, I asked them, can you give me an example of British commercial TV producing quality documentary series? And all of my friends together found one, which I'm not going to quote because it's not important. Whereas everybody agreed that on the BBC there were 20, 30. So this is one example of a genre where the BBC has a very good argument that they're much better. But like I say, it doesn't work like that in every genre. Unfortunately, life would be too simple. Now let's have a look at how the BBC changed over the years, because the history of the BBC can only be grasped by considering the gradual development it has gone through, as it necessarily mirrored a changing society. The centrality of elite values and interests no doubt became less all-powerful as the decades went by. For example, at the beginning, in the 20s and 30s, if you had a working-class voice, a working-class accent, or a regional accent, you had zero chance of being on the BBC. There's a famous story, I think it was in the 50s, when one of the director-generals heard a Birmingham accent on the radio and said, "Get that horrible thing off my radio." They spoke BBC English, that is to say, bourgeois English. And this was very solidly considered to be superior, that's all. And this kind of rigid elitism became less the case. I'm not saying that elitism disappeared, but there is really no comparison. Now, this is in parallel with changes elsewhere in society. Perhaps you know the series Downton Abbey. Well, there was another series 50 years ago, the Forsyte Saga, which also spoke, and other ones too, 50 years ago, which also spoke of rich people and their servants. And if you look at them, they're very, very different. Today, in Downton Abbey, the servants are taken seriously, the problems in their lives are considered important. Now, I still think that Downton Abbey is a defense of elitism, but nevertheless, today in the 21st century, it's necessary to take the servant seriously and show you're taking the servant seriously. This was not the case 50 or 60 years ago on television. That's just one example that in society in general, elitism has been reduced. And the BBC shows that. And indeed, the question of regional accents is one of the signs of that. What other huge changes have happened during the 50 years, 75 years or so, 22 to 95, during these years? What other huge changes have happened? Well, the very slow and partial integration of women and of ethnic minorities into influential or visible positions in different kinds of broadcasts is an aspect of the process which is worthy of attention. This is one of the great women of the BBC. She's Barbara Blake Hannah, but I've forgotten all about her. Now, I will be looking at this in some detail, how the situation of women has changed in the BBC in two ways. First of all, what was it like to work for the BBC in the 20s, 30s, 40s, the workers? And number two, the representation of women. What did women look like in fiction, in game shows, and so on? And I found a wonderful example the other day. In the 1970s, I got an episode on YouTube from 1973 of a variety show called The Generation Game. It's a fun show. And the gentleman introduced the show and then welcomed his assistant. And she came on in a beautiful dress and said, "Oh, give us a twirl, turn round so everybody can see how beautiful you are." And it was absolutely clear and not a problem for the show that the woman was present only to be pretty and decorative. It was absolutely clear. Now, interestingly enough, 20 years later, in 1994, they invited the same gentleman to do one episode of the same game show again as a sort of commemoration. And he also introduced a beautiful woman assistant who told more jokes than him, answered him back. She was still the assistant, she wasn't the boss, but there was no way that it was presented in the same way, 1973 to 1994. And that's just one example. There has been a lot of change in how women were presented. So let me go through very quickly indeed, from 1926 to 1995, and give you some of the big moments in about 20 minutes. Well, in the early years, the leading influence on the BBC was the team formed by Scottish Calvinist John Reith. He was well known for his insistence on the moral role of broadcasting. Broadcasting will make people better people. He also had an attitude to the public which would be later be considered as paternalistic. He famously said, "People tell me the BBC does not give people what they want. But most people don't know what they want, and certainly they don't know what they need." So very beautiful quotation, but obviously an attitude which is more difficult to defend today. So what did he do? There wasn't much football on the BBC radio in the 1920s and 30s. People loved football, but football, really. There was lots of opera and classical music. Some popular music, dance music, which was the main form of popular music at the time. Some popular music was broadcast, but it was definitely looked down on. There, John Reith. Now, by the time John Reith retired in 1983, I should say that in the issue I just mentioned of the Revue Française de Civilisation Britannique, there is an excellent article about John Reith written by Trevor Harris, who is a great historian, in fact. I mean, I'm a great fan. And I really recommend that article. And it shows the things about John Reith, who, a very contradictory gentleman. A very contradictory gentleman, but we will come back to that. For example, in the 30s until 1938, he thought Hitler was a pretty good thing. Obviously not. And at the same time, he made a great effort to bring women into the BBC and to make sure they got top jobs. So contradictory people, you know. By the time John Reith retired, it was or left the BBC in any case, having had a huge influence, and it was almost time for the Second World War. Well, it sounds like a story there, but it isn't. Here you have a book which was written about the Second World War called Anti's War. Anti is a nickname given for the BBC, a tati. And I recommend this book, and indeed I'm pretty sure that on YouTube there is an interview with this gentleman, which is quicker than reading the book, about what happened to the BBC during the war. Well, of course, the Second World War was a great challenge for every institution, including the BBC. A sophisticated and largely secret censorship system was established. For example, because Russia, the BBC was a very respected news source during the Second World War, and indeed before and after. And since the Russia, the Soviet Union, was an ally of Britain, then some news didn't hit the BBC. For example, at one point when the Russian army massacred thousands of Polish soldiers, the BBC said nothing about this because Russia is our ally. But the BBC was shaken up by the war in other ways too. The censorship campaign was sometimes contested inside the BBC, and there were other crises too. And one of my favourites is the crisis of popular music in the BBC during the Second World War. And you think, when you think war, you don't think, oh, well, that will be a crisis for popular music. But it was, and the reason was the BBC had, as I had mentioned, a very elitist view of culture. Lots of classical music, a bit of popular music. And the BBC was run by an elite, and nobody was really going to change it in 1936 or 1937. And then suddenly in 1940, the British government discovered that British soldiers in Northern Africa, they all listened to German radio. Because German radio had popular music all day. And of course, this is German radio in English. And of course, between the popular music, they had news from the German government. This was a very serious problem for the British government. If you're organising a war, you don't want your army listening to the opposition radio. And so the BBC was ordered to immediately change the style of its programmes. And it established the Forces programme, the Pour les Forces Armées, which had huge amounts of popular music. Also, you know, letters from home. Oh, I have a message from the wife of John Burton in North Africa, and she says she misses you very much. Much more popular and emotional content than the BBC, which had been rather dour and canonical. So that's just an example of how the force of the war actually made them change their change the radio. What were the important events after the war? I'm going to come back to this chronology much more slowly, year by year, but I want to give you the general view first. Well, the BBC maintained its monopoly on television until 1955, although before 1955 the number of people with a television was really rather small. When I was very young at school in 1965, half the class had a television. That was that would be a route thing in a fairly neutral part of town, neither very poor nor very rich. And the BBC had a monopoly on radio until 1973. But this period of the post-war boom and the huge expansion in broadcasting, radio and television, the huge expansion in the size of the audience, the number of people having televisions, and then in the 70s, colour televisions, this period was punctuated by three important government reports. These are the government reports published by the Commissions of Inquiry. The Beveridge Report of 1951, not to be confused with the Beveridge Report about the welfare state in 1942, the Pilkington Report of 1962, and the Annan Report of 1977. And these were huge events for broadcasting. The government got together a committee of experts who worked for several months and produced a large report, sometimes 500 pages of report, about where broadcasting was at and what was possible and what was right for public services. And the people who were invited onto these committees were very happy. Oh yeah, no, television is just beginning. They've asked me for my opinion about what it should be. It's great, you know. What our committee decides will affect the lives of tens of millions of people, which was true. So these reports, and as I mentioned to you, there will be specific classes on the commissions of inquiry, which I won't be able to tell you everything about, but some of the big questions. Now, of course, in 1962, we had a Conservative government, so unsurprisingly, many of the people on the commission were of Conservative sympathy. Now, they weren't politicians on the committee. They would be cultural people or technical experts, but Sidibon Guerra, the Conservative government, would make sure that there were plenty of Conservatives, but they would not name only Conservatives to the committee, because they want to know what television and radio looks like to the entire population, so that they can decide on a policy which is stable and will last a long time. So you would have a minority of people who are not Conservative at all on the commission, because of course some of the discussions of the commission are not so political. Yeah. How many hours of children's television should we have every week? What's the best way to get television used in schools? It's not, you know, Conservatives and Socialists could have the same opinion on some of these things. And certainly sometimes, because we're used to political history, we sometimes imagine that everything about the BBC is political. It's not. There's a lot of it which is not, you know. What's the best kind of sports programmes to have? When should they be? These are important questions which affect people's lives in a big way, but which are not directly political, and you can agree with people about, even if you don't have the same things. Now, these reports I will come back to because they're very interesting, but certainly one of the things which was important is that the Conservative and the Labour governments defended differing ideas of the role of private broadcasting, of the role of commercial broadcasting, which brings me to one of the most surprising things in the history of the BBC, is that it's the centenary this next year. That's the reason for the question on the Agreg, is because it's a centenary next year, okay? There will be 100 books about the BBC, if you're not fed up about the BBC by the time you've taken the Agreg. And the most surprising thing about the BBC is that it's still there. Any one of the governments, and let's be realistic, any one of the Conservative governments, Conservative governments such as Margaret Thatcher's, who thought that privatisation was good, and that organising mass services by commercial companies was superior in every way. In the 1990s, governments privatised the railways in Britain. In the 1980s, they privatised the electricity, the gas, etc., etc., etc. And yet, so the surprising thing about the BBC is nobody ever privatised it. Which brings me to my every historian's favourite question. Why not? Difficult question to ask, the why not questions. Certainly one of the reasons, it was tremendously popular. And it still is very popular indeed. The debates went on about the kind of things we want on television, the kind of things we want on radio, and I'm thinking in particular about the 60s and 70s, and some of the main actors in these debates. And one of them was the National Viewers and Listeners Association, which was not a huge organization, but it was a very important organization. And this was led by a conservative woman who had a lot of influence, who was not a politician. She was called Mary Whitehouse. And she led an enormous campaign to clean up television. She was worried that there was too much sex on television, that there was too much violence on television, and that there were too many swear words. Eddie Cornwell, too many swear words on television. Now, both at the time and today, it's quite popular to mock Mary Whitehouse and to look for some of the more ridiculous things she said. She had a lot of influence. She was a serious conservative influence, and she wrote serious studies about the effect of violence on television on children. Now they are generally studies which I wouldn't agree with, but she certainly had a lot of influence. Another big political campaign in Britain, in particular in the 70s and 80s, was the demand from Welsh nationalists to have television in Welsh, to have a television station in Welsh. They had on BBC Two a few programmes in Welsh, but they wanted a Welsh television station. And they had a big campaign, a direct action campaign. We refuse to pay our television licence until we have a television channel in Welsh. And it is eventually successful in 1982 when Channel 4 Wales, Channel Pedwar Cymru, was established. And this is part of a much bigger history of Welsh national identity and Welsh national feeling, which is one of the major strands of British history in the 20th century. There is an article in the same review which I mentioned to you, Le Revue Française de Civilisation Britannique, by Stephanie Bory, about Wales and the BBC. And she quotes somebody saying, the BBC created Wales. Now, of course, this is a slightly provocative and exaggerated way of putting it. But what they're trying to say is that if you're a minority, if you're working with a minority language and trying to defend a minority language in the 20th century, if you don't have a television channel, you're going to lose. Of course, you can oblige children to learn it in school, your language. But if you want them to continue using it, you can't really get around the importance of television. Now, the history of the BBC also requires. Now, I'm going to jump a little bit because I'm coming back to that later. I'm coming back to that later in the series. Yes, I want to look then. So I've gone through some of the big events up to the 1980s, I want to look now at something different, and that is the three principles which were established by John Reith. We call them the Reithian principles or the Reithian principles. I really don't know how to pronounce it. And these are to inform, to educate, thank you, and to entertain. I can read your lips. That's good. To inform, to educate, and to entertain. Now, interestingly enough, John Reith is famous for these three principles. He didn't actually invent them. Somebody said it in the United States, and he said, oh, that's good, I'll take those. But he made them popular, and they have been entirely, I think almost entirely consensual, that everybody, from the left or the right, it seems to me, has said, yes, this is good. Inform, educate, entertain. Yeah. This is fine. So that's interesting itself, because to find a consensus about a major national institution is never easy. Occasionally, people have suggested a number four. I think it was Annan, but I'm not sure. One of the reports said number four: help the population adapt to a changing world. Mm-hmm. And somebody else, I think it was Tony Benn, suggested another number four: increase the variety of experience and knowledge of the population. Introduce them to new things that they wouldn't have seen otherwise. So these are interesting things, and it's very important to, because you might easily have to look at these three principles, but it's very important to see that they were not automatic. He could have chosen other ones, but let's have a look at them, because they're not so easy necessarily to understand. Because first, if we take the first one, information, so you receive information, and the first thing we think about is the news. But remember, you can get information from other kinds of program as well. Yeah? Quiz programs, science programs, you get information too. But let's stick to the news. Now, the position of the BBC News as being the view of the establishment, but with a reputation for balanced reporting, has led to it being celebrated all over the world. Since 1932. It has had a world radio service. This was named in 1965 the World Service. Do you know what it was called before? What do you imagine it was called before? From 1932 till 1965, you have 5 seconds to write your idea into the chat. What was the World Service called before, from 1932 to 1965? Well, shall I tell you? I can't hear you. Shall I tell you? Oh, okay. It was called the Overseas Something Good Idea, because it was called Overseas Service, but only for a year or two. For 30 years, it was called the Empire Service. Right. C'est déjà another way of looking at the world. Yeah, it was called the Empire Service from 1932 to 1965. And then the World Service. Je crois qu'effectivement, c'était overseas pendant 2 ans au milieu, but not very important. The World Service, the Empire Service, and then the World Service represented significant soft power for the British state. I'm sure you know the expression soft power. Hard power is when you have the army in Africa somewhere. Soft power is influence. And the BBC is big influence. And one of the reasons I chose the BBC to write the question for the aggregation is that if you go all over the world, the two most famous things about Britain are, one, the Queen, two, the BBC. It's, I think the BBC is more well known than the Beatles. There you go. I suppose I should test. I'll ask the University of Rouen to give me money to travel the world to ask people if they think the BBC is... No, they won't give it me. That's not going to work, is it? So the BBC's role in moments of national crisis is particularly important. During the Second World War, I mentioned. During the Suez Crisis in 1956. During the war in Northern Ireland. Well, as you know, we say the Troubles in Northern Ireland because it was a rather low-level war, yeah, with a few dozen people dying every year. But it was a kind of war. Or the Falklands War in the 1980s. In moments of national crisis, moments of national crisis, then the BBC was tremendously important as a way of showing the world to us, and of course, showing the world in a particular way. Which reminds me of one of the things I wanted to say about the BBC in general. If you want a general characteristic of what is broadcasting, well, broadcasting is the way that the nation tells stories about itself to itself. So we see the world through television, and in fact, we see more of the world through television than from our personal experience. For example, if we take factory workers, I know 5 or 6 factory workers. But every year on television, I see hundreds. So if somebody asks me, what do you think of factory workers? I'm probably taking most of what I think from the parts of the television which I believe. I don't believe everything they say, of course. It's the same thing, it's like, we say, we mustn't work on stereotypes about the Japanese. But again, I know 2 Japanese people. But on the television, I often see things. So the broadcasting is tremendously important. It presents the world to us. And it tells stories about the world to us. And in particular, it explores what is worrying about the world. Everybody loves fiction about what is worrying. Love. Illness. Love is very worrying. Love. Illness. We make films about what is worrying. Relationships. Number one, so anyway, I'm getting carried away. Number one was to inform. Number two, to educate. Now again, the first thing we might think is documentaries. Now, they could be news documentaries like Panorama. Panorama has produced a weekly news documentary every week since 1950. Sorry, since 1953. In Britain, we like programmes that last a long time. Very good reputation. So that's one kind of documentary, the news documentary. But another kind is the sort I spoke about a moment ago, the history of modern art, or the history of music, or the history of science, that kind of thing. So that's part of the educate thing. But of course, people can be educated by fiction. Sometimes we get education through fiction because it shows us a situation which we didn't know about it, and it tries to present truths about that situation. I'm going to come back to that. And finally then, I did want to say a bit more about that. The BBC and education is far more than just documentaries. For example, the BBC Schools programme from the late 50s, I would say, from the late 50s on, was very important. When I was young, unfortunately I'm very old, so I can tell you about things before the war, the Iraq war. Schools television for schools was very important. Now, it was a little unwieldy. At 11 o'clock on Wednesday mornings in my school when I was 8, the teacher would go out into the cupboard and wheel in a big television. Remember, these are not flat screens, these are heavy televisions. And also, there were no videotapes, so you couldn't record the programme. You had to have the children in front of the programme on Wednesday at 11 o'clock. Now, your teachers, you know how hard this must be. Nobody knows where the key is for the cupboard with the television, etc. Some things haven't changed, yeah? And the BBC Schools programme was very, very important and very popular. And for teachers, it was really something new because it was the first ever time you could show children moving pictures about science, for example, and then afterwards use it in different ways. It was integrated into. Now, I know that you can do this more easily these days, although not always that easily, because the theory of how much technology you have in your college, where you're a teacher, is not the same as the reality. So BBC Schools, and another one, the Open University. Now, the Open University was established by the Labour government of 1964 to 70. And the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, when he was asked much later, what is the political act you are most proud of? He said, establishing the Open University. The Open University was a university where most of the work was done at home. It was a separate university, a real university. It was not attached to another university. And most of the work was done at home. You received books through the post. There were special BBC radio programmes, often at 6 o'clock in the morning, special BBC television programmes. And then for 2 or 3 weeks in the summer, you went to the university. And this allowed a lot of adults who had not been to university, working class people mostly, to take a degree, and the BBC was very much involved in that. A couple more ways in which the BBC was involved in education, and in which the BBC was involved as a public service, because the Open University and schools programmes, commercial companies were not going to do this. First of all, because most teachers don't want adverts during the school's programs. It's considered to be a bit iffy. So this was a public service to produce programs for schools. And similarly, they were involved in other public services. In the 1970s, there were a series of adult literacy programs on television. Yes, because as you know, by the 1970s, with universal education, almost everybody could read and write. But there were adults who could not read and write, and it was a difficult situation because they were often very ashamed of the fact that they couldn't read and write. They could not read and write. Il faut dire qu'à l'époque aussi, la remédiation en cours de scolarité était très très limitée. Celui au fond de la classe, on n'y pensait pas. Il ne savait pas lire, il ne savait pas lire. With a little bit like that. And so the BBC launched this adult literacy programmes. The most famous one in 1975 was called On the Move. Yeah, On the Move. I only give you one example. I've got three here, but if I give you three, that's too many. You just need to know one. I think you might find an episode on YouTube to watch a little bit. And so this was public service broadcasting. The commercials wouldn't do this. The commercial television wouldn't do this. Another example, the BBC produced languages such as Make Yourself at Home from 1965, which were languages partly in English and partly in Gujarati and Punjab, which were the most popular immigrant languages at the time. And these were to help immigrants to understand British administration and to learn better English. Again, a public service. The third big Reithian slogan is to entertain, and quite naturally you cannot have anything like a comprehensive knowledge of BBC entertainment repertoires over several decades. I already mentioned there are more than a million hours altogether, but it's good to be familiar with some major strands within it and to have an analytical perspective. Entertainment programmes, whether they are quiz shows, soap operas, music programmes, sports programmes or sitcoms, they both reflect changes in society and participate in the changing of people's worldviews. And one area where this is particularly visible is in the field of inclusivity. In the period under consideration, 1922 to 1995, discriminated groups such as women, ethnic minorities or homosexuals were gradually able to take up more space in the public arena, and the more heavily stereotyped present representations went into relative decline. That's the case in society in general. When I was 15 years old and I was at school, I heard racist jokes every week. It was difficult to be surprised. I don't know many 15-year-olds, but when I do talk to 15-year-olds, they say it's not like that. It doesn't mean they've never heard a racist joke, but it's not, you know, it really was just soaked in the place. It was absolutely disgusting. So let me use the example of the extremely popular soap opera EastEnders. Now, when you're thinking, you may know something about soap operas, but it's tremendously important not to confuse British soap operas with French soap operas such as Plus Belle la Vie. Many people like Plus Belle la Vie, but you don't have 10 million people obsessed with it who love it. Whereas in Britain, you do. Very often, the highest viewer numbers for the whole year is EastEnders. And when the British go away on holiday to another country, they phone home to ask what happened in EastEnders. There are magazines where you can write letters of advice to the characters to tell them how to live their life. Now, it does sound a little bit, you s'en fous ces anglais, quoi. It is very, very important. And what's important about it is the characters in EastEnders, for example, are almost considered to be part of the family. And that means that the appearance of the first gay character in 1986 or the first Asian character in 1993 and the way they were treated, these programmes may have had more effect on combating prejudices than 100 documentaries at 11 o'clock at night with university teachers telling people it's bad to be racist. So this can be huge. Effects. So entertainment included could be very serious in its effect. Of course, entertainment is entertainment, but also sometimes it's something very serious. Grange Hill lasted for 20 years, I think, and it was about an ordinary school. Of course, it wasn't really ordinary. It was a bit more melodramatic because, you know, filming ordinary life is not a great idea. If you imagine that you were awake for 14 hours yesterday, well, you could make 14 episodes of 1 hour of realistic, real-life television, but it would probably be pretty boring. I'm not saying anything that your life is more boring than anybody else's. It probably is, but, you know, I wasn't saying that. Okay. Also in entertainment, series such as The Palaces, 1974, or the Fortnite Saga, 1967, catered to the desire of audiences in Britain, and perhaps just as importantly abroad, to enjoy the sights of British aristocratic and bourgeois lifestyles steeped in tradition. And this is the same appeal which we see in The Crown, which is not BBC, of course, or in Downton Abbey. let's have a little, staying with entertainment, let me say a couple of things about music programs, which is my speciality, popular music. And here I'm going to give you three examples of music programs. And one of them is this one, Jukebox Jury, which lasted from 1959 to 1967, and then had occasional comebacks just for one episode. In 1978 and 1987, said, "Oh, you know, for the 10-year anniversary, let's have one episode." And they're very interesting to see how they changed. And as you can see, this is the Jukebox Jury. They're well-known people. Notice that the men have suits and ties on. This is 1961, I think. The men have suits and ties on. We have women present. That must have appeared very progressive at the time. And this is a fascinating program. And what they do is very simple principle. They play a new song which has just come out, a new record, and the panel has to say if it will be a hit, if it will sell a lot of records, or if it will be a miss. That's what they have to do. And what is fascinating about it is that the jury are very negative about popular music. Some say, "Oh, the person who wrote that should be shot." I'm quoting. Yeah. Now, of course, they don't mean they're really going to organise a shooting, but very, very, oh, this terrible young people's music is awful. Which is a very interesting kind of way television programme to have. And in fact, it was successful because it attracted two audiences. It attracted teenagers who wanted to listen to their music on the radio, on the television, and see singers on the television. And it attracted their parents who wanted to listen to these people very cleverly insulting the pop music producers. So it's a very fascinating thing. Sometime later, and you can see it lasted 1964 to 2006, that's a successful program. You had Top of the Pops every Thursday night for 40 minutes or so. They produced it. They presented a few of the hits which have had sold the most. Completely different atmosphere. The presenters, who were disc jockeys, never said anything negative about any song. It was a party. There were people dancing. It was a party. Here's a wonderful song, and after that we'll have another wonderful song followed by a marvelous song. It's a completely different atmosphere. And finally, the Old Grey Whistle Test, 1971 to 1988, was the first television programme to take popular music seriously. They invited somebody, a new young singer, and they said, "Okay, well, you know, play us five songs." Not one song, five songs. And they discussed what was new about it. This was the site, because this was the period when, just before this, both the Beatles and Bob Dylan had convinced people that popular music can be taken seriously and is not just for dancing on a Saturday night. The Old Grey Whistle Test was the first television programme to show The Bird, a whole series of extremely well-known classic rock groups. The chapter which I wrote in the book edited by Georges Fournier is about this, is about the BBC and popular music. The last thing I want to say in this general introduction is something about sitcoms. And this is a good question for public service broadcasting, because I've noticed that if we look at BBC sitcoms in the 70s and 80s in particular, my impression is that commercial television did better, that they had more popular sitcoms. However, the BBC did have some good sitcoms. This one, for example, The Good Life, 1975 to 78. And the situation, because a situation comedy is that the situation is funny, and you have a story, a different story every week. The story here is that this gentleman used to work with a very good job, a very well-paid job as a designer or a technician or an engineer. And he and his wife decided that they wanted to go back to nature and grow their own food and keep their own animals and make their own clothes. But, to make it funny, they decided not to move house but to stay in the bourgeois part of town where they lived. And make their garden into a place where you could keep pigs, of course. And naturally enough, you're not surprised to hear that the neighbours next door were extremely bourgeois and respectable and posh, and so the conflict is... Now, I don't know if it dates, because I'm too old to know, but it seems to me very good. You can find some of this on YouTube, and I'd be interested to see if it's still funny. So it's not so easy to still be funny 50 years later. Very often so you can see that there was a link to a social question, because the question of going back to nature was a real question in the 70s. And here's another one which has a link to a social question. It's not unusual to have a link to a social question. And this is the Liverbirds, 1970s again. I will come to your question in just a moment, if it's a question. At the time, there were many, many sitcoms about young men. Lots of them. 5, 10, 15. And what was original about this was about two women. Two young women who lived together, and it was about them. And they were at the centre. And this at the time was quite new and also quite progressive. All right, you're sorry you have to go. That's fine. Well, I will see you next time. Thank you for being here. There we go. Now, I have a second part in just a moment. That is the end of the first part. And now I'm just going to get you to just listen to another couple of minutes, and I will be back in 2 minutes. Post-determinate.